If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. It's more than 2,000 years since the Greek philosopher Socrates was accused of atheism. And since then, the contention that a god or gods do not exist has been on quite a journey. It's a story that takes in the Middle Ages, when professing a lack of faith could place you in serious danger, the surge of scepticism following the Reformation, and the rise of communist states that attempted to stamp out religious faith. Spencer Mizzen sat down with Alec Ryrie, professor in the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University, to discuss everything you wanted to know about the history of atheism.
So, Alec, I thought we'd start with a question submitted by Susan Politz on Twitter. And that is there much difference between an atheist and an agnostic? And I wonder if you could then kind of use that as an opportunity to provide us with a definition of atheism. What does it mean to be an atheist?
That's a really good question. I think it's an essential starting point. And those two words, atheist and agnostic, do offer a great way into it, because the history of those words is really different. Agnostic is a very modern word. It comes out of the mid-19th century, out of all those kind of classic science religion debates in the wake of Darwin's Origin of Species, and emerges because by that point, atheist had taken on a really precise meaning, which is still the meaning that we give to it today broadly. Whereas, you know, nowadays we would say an atheist is someone who asserts that there is no God. So it's about making a definite metaphysical claim. And the idea of an agnostic is somebody who does not claim to know. You know, it means derives from the Greek word gnosis for knowledge. Agnos, it's someone who does not know whether or not there is a God, who is not claiming certainty. Atheism has often in modern times been attacked as dogmatic, as laying down, you know, for a certainty that there is no God, with the same kind of conviction that religious believers are often supposed to have. And so agnosticism is a deliberate attempt to separate itself out from that. But if you go back into the longer history of this word, atheist, you get quite a different feel for it. And I think this is really important, because it's not just in terms of the history, it's how this whole idea has developed. I mean, obviously enough, it's a Greek word. The original word is atheos, and the origins and meaning of that are something much closer to an English word like godless than to our sense of kind of philosophical atheism. It's always included that kind of core sense of asserting that there is no God or that there are no gods. Yeah. But the ancient usages of this word are much more like people who live in a godless way, who live and think and act without reference to God or to the gods. So when Socrates is famously accused of atheism, this is because he is seen as being impious, of rejecting what the gods of ancient Greece stand for. The fact that when in ancient times that Greek word atheos is translated into Latin, the Latin word that's chosen for it as the equivalent is impius, gives you a sense of the range of meaning that we have here. So this is much more about about how you act and the role or lack of role that religion has in your life than necessarily what your metaphysical claims about the being or non-being of a deity might be. In that sense, it makes perfect sense in the ancient world, for example, the early Christians, to be accused of being atheists, despite the fact that, of course, they vehemently assert their belief in one God, because they are denying the gods of the society in which they stand, and it's an act of impiety, and that's virtually the same thing.
Now, Polina Panchakova asks, when did the term atheism first appear, and when did it enter the lexicon? Now, you've just referenced there atheism existing back in antiquity, but would I be right in saying that it didn't actually enter usage until quite a lot later than that?
Well, it's certainly around and very much part of public discourse in antiquity, and I think that remains important. It's a fairly widespread concept at that point, but without a huge moral charge attached to it, because it has this meaning of impiety or irreligion. And in the very religiously plural societies of the ancient world, that was just a phenomenon. And in particular, there were philosophical schools in antiquity, like Epicureanism, that are fairly openly seen as atheistic, not in the sense that somebody like Lucretius denies that there is a God. He simply denies that it matters, that whether or not there is a God is a metaphysical speculation with no relevance for human life. But as Christianity begins to spread within the Roman world and to make its presence felt, this idea acquires more of a charge. I mean, there's a famous exchange that's recorded in the second century during the account of the martyrdom of Polycarp, one of the first Christian martyrs, who we've got a full account of his death, where when he is brought to the arena and offered the opportunity to recant before being executed, the Roman governor, who's trying to persuade him to back down, says, won't you make a sacrifice to the emperor and say down with the atheists? Yeah. The governor, of course, meaning Christians as atheists. And Polycarp refuses to make the sacrifice to the emperor, but he will say down with the atheists, because, of course, for him, it has the opposite meaning. Sure. For him, it's the people around him who are worshipping these false gods who are atheists, who are impious in that sense. So you can see there that this word is acquiring that kind of polemical edge. But once Christianity becomes the dominant religion of the Roman world, and then really the established and only religion of the post-Roman world, aside from the presence of Jews, which remains significant, from the 5th, 6th centuries onwards, then this word atheist largely fades out of out of use. And significantly, it's never translated into Latin in this period. There's never a Latin equivalent which has those sorts of philosophical resonances. There are terms like unbelief which are being used. And you know, through the Middle Ages, you see people periodically brought up before church courts on charges that would usually be framed as blasphemy for denying some fundamental aspect of Christian doctrine, including sometimes explicitly denying that or questioning whether there is a God. So that's an issue. It's a perennial one, and if it's not actual denial of the being of God, then you will find, you know, almost sort of, you know, constructive forms of atheism, you might say, of denials of other aspects of Christian doctrine, such as the immortality of the soul, that are seen as so fundamental that they amount to utter denial of the religion.
Sure. Yeah.
But that word, that Greek term atheist, is not used to apply to them. It's only in the Renaissance that starts to come into Western sure. Latin usage.
Okay, great. I'm now going to turn to a question submitted by TW on social media, and that is, how would people react if you said you were an atheist in the medieval period? Now, I guess the Middle Ages are very much known as the Age of Faith, in Europe at least. So is there much evidence for atheism in this period?
Okay, well, first of all, atheism as such, no, because that term isn't being used. So if you said you were an atheist, then they would say, you know, that's all Greek to me, no idea what you mean. If you said you were an unbeliever, or if you said I do not believe there is a God, then you would probably be in a fair amount of trouble. At least you could be. It would depend on somebody denouncing you. Obviously, you know, the Middle Ages is a long time, covers a big part of the world. There's, you know, an awful lot of variety within that period.
Sure.
But certainly by the later Middle Ages, when the records are better, when the church courts are set up in a more systematic way, and in particular where the Western Church's systems for policing heresy and dissent are quite well established, we see a pretty steady stream, steady trickle, of people being accused of statements that we could put in that kind of big bucket of atheistic comments. It's a fairly regular source of accusations. It's often the sort of thing that gets labeled as blasphemy. Very often, these are the sorts of things that people say when they're drunk or when they're gambling, cursing God when the dice fall against them, this sort of thing. And these things are taken with, you know, varying degrees of seriousness. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century writes quite carefully about the issue of blasphemy, and, you know, effectively says, you know, some people just say this kind of thing when they're angry, they're letting off steam, and it's bad, it's a sin, but it's not something to be taken too seriously. It's not the same as, you know, soberly and deliberately claiming there is no God, which would not only be blasphemy, it would be heresy. And for a baptized Christian to assert such things deliberately after correction could ultimately lead to the standard judicial punishment for heresy, which would be execution by burning. There are not many medieval cases where things actually reached that point. Most people who are accused of such things are willing to back down, or we find the accusation being made after their deaths. But there's another side to this, which I think is quite important, which is that often these kinds of claims during the medieval period appear more as pastoral problems than as disciplinary ones. So somebody coming forward saying, I am struggling to believe this, you know, going to their priest, saying, you know, how can I believe that my soul will live on after my death? Or, I mean, maybe this is the most characteristic place where doubt clusters in the Middle Ages. How can I truly believe in the miracle of transubstantiation? How can I believe that the bread and wine on the altar is truly miraculously transformed into Christ's body and blood?
Was it a case of people doubting and being troubled by their doubts? They didn't want to doubt, but yet they kind of couldn't stop themselves.
That very much seems to be a theme. I mean, I think that's a theme that runs right through the period from the Middle Ages right up into modernity. And the awareness amongst clergy that this is a pastoral problem, that they've got to help people who are wrestling with these sorts of doubts is, you know, this is a common theme in the pastoral writing of the period. One of the most common, one of the most frequently recurring miracle stories of the Middle Ages is of Eucharistic visions. This is of people who are at Mass witnessing, you know, the celebration of the sacrament of Holy Communion, when, according to Catholic doctrine, the bread and wine are miraculously but imperceptibly transformed into the true body and blood of Christ, and that these people who have doubted the truth of that miracle in these stories are granted a vision of what is truly happening on the altar and are seeing hunks of human flesh and Christ standing on the altar pouring out his blood. Visions which, in these stories, they always regard as horrifying and beg to be taken away from them. But the fact that those stories are so often told, we have to take as an index of the fact that there is widespread doubt of people struggling to truly believe these things.
Okay, I'm going to move forward a few centuries with a question from Gavin Griffiths. He says, the playwright Christopher Marlowe was often described as an atheist, but what exactly would that have meant to somebody living in the 16th century? Now, we kind of know that Christopher Marlowe said some fairly punchy things during his lifetime, but I'd like to expand on that a little by asking, given the background to all this, how did the Reformation change the picture for atheism? Did it drive a lot of people to atheism?
That's a great question. I think it's a really important juncture in this story in the West. It's when atheism moves to being at the centre of people's religious anxieties. It's not a coincidence that this is the period when that word actually re-enters Western Christian discourse. The first use of it in Latin that we know of is from 1501, but it's then in the, you know, this is part of the general rediscovery of Greek during the Renaissance. It then makes its way very quickly into all of the major vernacular languages of Western Europe. English is one of the last ones to pick it up. First recorded use of the word atheist in English is in 1553. And it becomes really very widely established after that. So, I mean, by the time Marlowe is being accused of atheism in the early 1590s, everybody knows what this word means. And I think that itself tells you something. It shows that by the time this word appears, there's already a lively market for it. It's a word that fills a need. So, I mean, if we go back to what Martin Luther is doing at the beginning of the Reformation in the late 1510s, at the risk of stating the obvious, Martin Luther's not an atheist. He is doing two things. He and his followers and successors and allies are doing two things which really help to bring this to center stage. One of them is that for Luther, his entire reconception of Christianity is based on this idea of faith alone, salvation by faith alone, which means the question of faith becomes absolutely central to defining what a Christian is in that Protestant world, and of course it forces Catholics to respond likewise. The idea of belief then suddenly has to carry an enormous weight, and this really puts this question of well, do you believe? Do you truly believe? Is your belief saving belief? Or do you fail in belief in some way, which is not quite the same thing as atheism, but can tip over very, very, very easily into it? So in that sense, it makes the idea of failed or insufficient belief become something that haunts a great many Christians. So that's one way it matters. The other, and rather more prosaically, is that one of the things that the Luther and the Protestant movement does is deploys a vicious, withering skepticism at a great many of the claims, traditional claims of Catholic Christianity. Transubstantiation, maybe most obviously, but the authority of the Pope, a great many of the practices, rites, and traditions of Catholic Christianity, the Protestants say this is all nonsense. There's no reason to believe this. Yeah. And they're not just deploying that kind of withering skepticism, of throwing unbelief at it. They are, because of the nature of their movement, the fact that they're building this broad movement, using the popular press to build it up, they're weaponizing skepticism and then training the entire population in its use. And to some extent, the Catholic world, as it begins to regroup and fight back against the Protestant challenge, is doing the same thing, is turning back onto Protestants these same kind of skeptical argument. How can you possibly believe what this Luther says? You know, they claim that the Bible is the word of God. How do they even know that this book is the word of God? Of course, we as Catholics know it because the Church gives it to us. But the Protestants have no basis for that claim. So both sides in this argument pretty quickly are weaponizing skepticism and training populations in their use. And the trouble, of course, with distributing weapons to a whole population is that you can't entirely control what they're going to do with them.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that you begin to find during the course of the 16th century is that whole populations are being faced with religious choices that they've never had, that their ancestors haven't had for 1,000 years. And, you know, many of them do not want to make choices. Choosing your religion is not what you're supposed to do. It's one of the hallmarks of heresy. But you've kind of got no choice but to be making choices in the 16th century, which is a profoundly disturbing and destabilizing thing to do. And whatever you believe, you are also rejecting a whole series of other beliefs. And this is why it's been said, I think this is true, that by the end of the 16th century, everyone in Europe is an atheist from someone's perspective. Because both sides are accusing one another vehemently of atheism. As I said, the term is very widespread. It remains almost exclusively, I mean, as far as we know, exclusively a term of abuse. We don't have anybody from this period. Marlowe does not, to our knowledge, use this term about himself. But the conviction by the end of the 16th century that there are atheists everywhere, that it's parallel to the way that the era talks about witches, that they're this secret but universal plague, just sort of lurking beneath the surface of Christendom. There's a real kind of collective moral panic about the spread of this, and then in the 17th century that comes more into the open.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think one of the lessons of the Eastern and Western experiences of atheism in the 20th century, the communist and capitalist experiences, is that communism tried much harder than anyone in the capitalist world ever did to exterminate Christianity, but capitalism actually did the job much more effectively.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
But at this point, then, it's still very much a pejorative term. You don't have people coming out and declaring, I'm an atheist and I'm proud of it. It's still something that can very much land you in trouble then.
You know, very much so. People are still facing disciplinary proceedings in various jurisdictions, still facing execution potentially for atheism. I mean, famously, the last person to be executed for atheism in Britain is a Scottish student in 1698. Which is admittedly kind of freakishly late, and that's regarded at the time as a bit of a throwback. But still, you know, that shows what could happen. These are still not sentiments that anybody would be wise to express openly.
Right, now it's impossible to have a discussion about the history of atheism without mentioning the Enlightenment. I mean, this great philosophical and intellectual movement is widely seen as supercharging the rise of disbelief. Is that true? And if so, why?
Okay, so I mean the old stereotype of the Enlightenment as a basically atheistic movement is misleading, but it's not completely wrong. I think we've had a real awareness over in Enlightenment scholarship over the last generation or so of how plural and especially how moderate parts of the Enlightenment are. Now, awareness of moderate Enlightenments, of Catholic Enlightenments, the extent to which there are parts of this very broad movement that are explicitly trying to rebuild and reframe forms of Christianity. I mean, for myself, I think that if you look at the great evangelical revivals of the 18th century, Methodism, the Great Awakening in the American colonies, Pietism and Moravian movements in Europe, I think these have to be seen very much as Enlightenment phenomena. And in particular, the emphasis that those evangelical movements place on religious experience rather than on authority. I mean, that's a very Enlightenment idea. Yeah. You know, it's in the same way as the scientists are saying, you know, my evidence is that I've seen it with my own eyes. The revivalists are saying, well, I know this is true because I've felt it in my own heart. That the linguistic overlap between experience and experiment is not an accident.
Yeah.
So there's all that going on. And for that reason, I think it's really misleading to think of the Enlightenment as a fundamentally anti-religious movement. But you do also have this phenomenon of the so-called radical Enlightenment, those who are much more openly, much more fundamentally challenging some of the core philosophical assumptions of the day. And at the head of that, certainly in these regards, stands Baruch Spinoza, the Dutch Jewish philosopher who in the 1660s begins to publish a series of texts which lead to him being described as the philosophical father of modern atheism, which is sort of fair in that Spinoza is really the first modern philosopher to construct a philosophical system in which is able to make coherent sense of the world without invoking God. But it's also pretty clear, I think, that Spinoza himself is not an atheist in any sense of the word. His faith, which is maybe closer to the kind of post-Christian rationalism of groups like the Dutch Collegians or indeed the English Quakers, who he's quite close to, He's maybe closer to that than he is to the Judaism in which he's raised, you know, by the time he reaches his mature views. But he is very clear that one of the reasons that he wants to develop the arguments he does against, you know, the authority of the Bible and so forth, is because he wants to create a purer theology, and that his understanding of his faith needs to be rationalized, not in order to demolish it, but to correct it. Right. And indeed, some of the arguments that he makes against traditional Christian and Jewish theological positions are very much theological arguments. He says that the idea of miracles is offensive to the notion of the majesty of God, that God should be so inept as a creator that he has to kind of to meddle in his universe in this way. And that, I think, is a recurrent feature of a lot of the voices of the radical Enlightenment, who can be explicitly anti-Christian or anti-Orthodox Christianity in their arguments. So, I mean, Voltaire is maybe the most obvious case here, or the Anglo-American revolutionary Tom Paine, who produces the first really successful anti-Christian bestseller, his book The Age of Reason, in the 1790s. And these people can be vicious in their attacks on the traditional churches, but they're usually pretty clear that what they are trying to do is not to abolish the whole theological enterprise, but to do it right.
So they're not attacking faith per se.
They're not attacking faith per se. They're attacking particular manifestations of it and trying to change it. And I mean, right at the heart of the French Revolution itself, you see this going. You know, in the early 1790s, there's a ferocious attack on the Catholic Church from the revolutionary French regimes. There's explicitly a de-Christianizing policy which is being taken. Of course, for all of their opponents across Europe, they're regarded as horrible atheists, and this is utterly shocking. But Robespierre in France in 1793-94 is trying to replace Christianity with the cult of the supreme being. This is a kind of rationalistic religion. His contemporaries would call it atheist because it's impious in their terms. But when we look back at it with our perspective, you know, we have to say, okay, maybe this is deistic, that it is faith in God into something very different. But you know, that's not something that, say, a Richard Dawkins would recognise as proper atheism.
Just to move forward a little bit, what about Darwin's theory of evolution? How did that change the picture? I mean, what did that do to a lot of people's sort of conception of their faith and Christianity?
I mean, this is one of the key turning points, obviously. But again, it plays out, I think, a little bit differently from the way our stereotype of it has come to work, partly because off the back of the post-Darwin debates, people like T.H. Huxley, the man who coins the term agnostic to describe his position, Darwin's bulldog supposedly, start to formulate a wider thesis of a conflict between science and religion, both of which are slightly problematic abstract terms. And this idea really emerges in the wake of Darwin's book and is then kind of rolled out forward and backwards in time to become a kind of big explanation for everything that's happened since the 17th century. And that really doesn't work. Insofar as that classic science-religion conflict happens, it does happen during that later 19th century period. Of course, a great many Christians find Darwin's theories perfectly workable, and if there are problems that they have with it, it's more to do with some of the kind of precise theological implications of its interpretation rather than with the basic claims as such. One of the reasons that there's a whole series of reasons why many other Christians find Darwinism unacceptable, and while they're willing to bend and adapt on a whole variety of issues, this becomes a point on which many of them want to make a stand. Its implications about human racial difference become a problem, actually on both sides, because Darwinism is both used to argue that human beings are fundamentally the same, and there are some, especially in the Americas, who find that really offensive. But equally, Darwinism is being used increasingly by the late 19th century to argue actually that the human so-called races are profoundly different from one another. And that really is offensive to classic Christian understanding of human unity. And so there's a lot of progressive or sort of left-wing Christians who are opposed to Darwinism because they see it as an essentially racist philosophy. But it's plainly the case that one of the things that Christianity had leaned on in the arguments that it had been making against various forms of doubt for a couple of hundred years is various forms of the argument from design. You know, that a created world shows the signs of God at work. And really, for the first time from the 1860s onwards, you've got a really thorough, well-worked-out answer to that. And it means that it becomes possible to construct a kind of a widespread alternative theory of an understanding of the world. I don't think in itself that's decisive, but it provides intellectual cover for some of the deeper changes that are happening in society, which are maybe more to do with, you know, in terms of the people who are introducing big ideas in the 19th century, it's maybe less to do with Darwin and more to do with Marx.
So what was Marx's views on this then? I mean, actually, I wanted to kind of take you on to my next question a little bit, because I wanted to talk about the link between state-directed atheism and communism in the 20th century. I wanted to get a sort of feel for what drove this. What, for example, did, say, Joseph Stalin hope to gain by disentangling state from church?
Okay, well, I think here again we need to go back to the French Revolution, because this is where this long antagonism, but it goes back further than that, which is the most obvious place that you can see it, where there's long antagonism between political revolutionary movements of the modern era and organized Christianity really plays out. That the French revolutionaries, for good reasons, regard the Catholic Church as one of their most powerful, most dangerous institutional opponents, a defender of the existing social, economic, political order, and therefore something that simply has to be swept out of the way, and something that they regard as morally offensive because of its participation, as they see it, in the oppression of the masses. And Marx absolutely picks up on and runs with this idea, you know, in the context of 19th century Europe, where you've got this division between various liberal and nationalistic forces on the one side and various conservative traditionalist forces on the other. It's pretty clear that the churches, most churches, are strongly on the side of established power, of existing social hierarchies. They're suspicious towards liberalism, towards democracy, and all those kinds of movements. And Marx's argument famously is that religion is the opium of the people. That, and this is his famous doctrine of false consciousness, the idea that this is one of the things that is used to deceive the masses into failing to act in their own interests by promising them offering them these deceptive promises of future salvation in return for compliance, obedience, and handing over all their money to churches and other overlords here and now. Now, it's obviously a problematic argument, the assumption that you know what people want better than they want themselves is, you know, let's say, a recurrent problem of Marxist and revolutionary philosophies. But, I mean, you can also absolutely see his point and the extent to which there is that that intimate connection between churches of various kinds and the existing the old regimes of political power in the 18th, 19th, into the early 20th centuries is you know, absolutely clear, and maybe clearer nowhere than was the case in pre-revolutionary Russia, where the Orthodox Church was you know deeply entangled with the Tsarist regime, which presented Moscow as the third Rome, very much see themselves as the heirs of the Caesars and of the Byzantine emperors in that way. So it's not at all surprising that communist regimes would regard religion in general and Christian churches in particular as some of their most dangerous antagonists, both simply as alternative centers of social power, but also because of the particular track record that, in their view, these institutions have for deceiving the people, and using these sort of metaphysical promises to lure them away from their true political interests. And I mean, my sense certainly is that 20th century communists deduce their metaphysics from that political insight. They know that the churches, as they have met them, are wicked institutions. Therefore, the claims that they're making about the nature of reality and of God must be untrue.
Right.
And so it becomes one of the determining features of communist regimes in a great many settings, that they want to try to stamp out religious practice. And I mean, that's done with varying degrees of aggression. You know, at one extreme, you've got the communist regime in Albania, or indeed in China during the Cultural Revolution, the period when religious practice of any kind is completely prohibited. In many other communist regimes, there's a sense that, religion is the opium of the people, it must ultimately die. Marx's theory of history says that, it's a relic. But of course, you take that view, then you can easily say, well, in which case, it's a matter of time. We can afford to relax and let it die a natural death, as long as it is kept in a politically controlled place in the meantime. And this is what you see in much of the Soviet bloc. And of course, it doesn't work terribly well. And you see, Poland is the most obvious example of where in fact the churches become a real locus of, I say the churches, one church in particular, becomes a real locus of resistance and of reforming an identity against communism. I think one of the lessons of the Eastern and Western experiences of atheism in the 20th century, the communist and capitalist experiences, is that communism tried much harder than anyone in the capitalist world ever did to exterminate Christianity, but capitalism actually did the job much more effectively.
That does lead me on to my next question, which was submitted by Michael Camp on social media. He asks, how is the character of contemporary atheism different from its predecessors? So I guess, where are we at with atheism at the moment? How does it look now compared to, say, 200 years ago?
It's a really good question. I mean, in some ways, freakishly similar to how it looked 200 years ago. You know, if you were to pick up, the writings of the so-called new atheists, the kind of Dawkins and Dennett and others in the early 20th century, there's not much in there that would have been unfamiliar to the anti-Christian polemicists of the Enlightenment of the 19th century. There's a few elements. Some of the, obviously, there's modern bits of science that are being applied to it. But it's a basically familiar structure. Indeed, quite a lot of it would seem comprehensible to Lucretius in ancient times. So in some ways, these are perennial themes. And I think if you look at atheism in a philosophical sense, that's true. But if you look at it as a social phenomenon, and I mean, obviously here, the really extraordinary thing is the way that explicit unbelief, that identifying as having no religion, has gone from being a marginal and extreme position in Western societies, you know, within living memory, to becoming, in many social contexts, not just the norm, but, you know, a norm from which it's really unusual to dissent in some in some circles. I mean, that's a really remarkable phenomenon. It's happened very quickly. And I mean, this is all a kind of a sort of, you know, the 1960s is, I think, classically and correctly seen as the pivot of this. One of the features of that shift towards a very widespread unbelief in the modern era is that it has felt intuitive to many of the people who embrace it. Just kind of seems obvious to a great many people now to identify as having no religion, without necessarily any clear sense of why it seems obvious. I mean, my reading of this is that it's above all to do with ethics, the way that providing an ethical framework, a real sense of what is right and wrong, was maybe the key social function of religion up until the early to mid-20th century. But post-Second World War, post the extraordinary moral shock of the Nazi genocide, the emergence of human rights as a moral norm, you know, human rights being something that we all believe in, you know, I believe in, but we struggle to articulate why. Where do human beings get these rights from? You know, it's a real kind of castle in the air. But it is one that we absolutely affirm and have that faith in. And therefore it feels that religion in general, Christianity in particular, no longer it's kind of redundant. It doesn't serve that purpose anymore. If that's so, then my suspicion is that our modern consensus around the lack of a need for any kind of religious structure, that, you know, we can simply place our faith in this new ethical system, I think it's a lot more fragile than it looks. That it depends on a set of intuitions which we assume we all share. I think it's reasonable to look at the history of our societies and of the world over the last 10 years or so and think actually some things are kind of unraveling, and that the consensus that we all thought we held is not nearly as firm as we liked to imagine. So my guess is that both belief and unbelief at the moment, you know, those two old dancing partners, are at an inflection point. Stuff's going to change over the next 10, 20, 30 years. It can't carry on the way it is, but, you know, I'm a historian. I don't know about the future, so don't ask me to predict what's actually going to happen. Just the blithe faith that many of us have that the world will carry on more or less the way it is seems to me ill-founded.
That was Alec Ryrie, professor in the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.